Okay, so today is Tuesday. Tomorrow is the last full day that we have to practice together. We started with practice of the six senses. So we note when the mind wanders away to something and we bring it back. To the meditation object. Meditation object is only there to give stability. What we're really trying to do is catch the mind and know what the mind is doing. So when we hear a sound, when we get lost or caught in that, and then we remember ourselves and say, oh yes, that was the sound. So you bring your attention back. That catching the mind is what's important. That is mindfulness right there. It's not really an exercise of absorbing yourself with the breath or being able to stay with the breath endlessly and continuously, which is more of a concentration practice. It's okay to concentrate. Concentration is a good practice to do, but we're really putting the emphasis on mindfulness or this quality of wakefulness. After a while, what you find is that you have a sense of awareness. While stuff is going on around you, while you can hear, while thinking is going on, while feeling is going on. And that's okay. You don't really need to be noting anymore at that point. Really, you want to note when you found yourself absorbed or caught in something, and you want to make a clean break on that thing. So with the six senses, we're cultivating a sense of I'm here. I'm awake. Don't get confused with self and non-self, that's another aspect or that's another quality. But the quality of presence, we can call it I'm here or I'm awake. When the Buddha, just after he was enlightened, somebody said to him, you look pretty cool. And he said, who are you? And the Buddha said, I'm awake. And the guy said, oh, well, very good, and wandered off. Wasn't too impressed. After that, the Buddha met somebody and they said, who are you? And he said, in this entire universe with its gods, its Brahmas, its Devas, its human beings, I see none who is my equal. And he said, oh, congratulations, and wandered off scratching his head. This is interesting. The Buddha did actually meet many people during his teaching career who didn't get the Dhamma. It's interesting that sometimes in Thailand, we find people come to the temple and they're looking for that teacher. One person said, I'm looking for a teacher who can see right through me. Can your teacher see right through me? I'm like, well, I don't know. You don't seem that deep. I mean, like, you know, if I just meet that teacher, then everything will come right. Sometimes you do meet a great teacher and they're inspiring, but you have to be careful with inspiration too, because I see many inspiration junkies. And sometimes in Thailand, I organize Dhamma talks with Ajahn Jayasaro, who's very well known. You can see many of his talks and things on the internet. And he just whistles stuff up off the top of his head. I mean, he has no system or anything, but he's very well respected. And sometimes people send me emails, and on the website, you can join the emailing list, and people send me emails and said, I want emails every time Ajahn Jayasaro is speaking. So I kind of send a nice email back and like, we have other speakers as well, you know. You know, we only have him once a year. But no, not as good as Ajahn Jayasaro. And, you know, they're kind of inspiration junkies. Other people are Ajahn Brahm fanatics. And, you know, when he comes, 600 people come out and they come and see Ajahn Brahm, and we have somebody else and 10 people come out. And it's not like even Ajahn Brahm. I mean, he in Singapore, I offered to do talks for his group in Singapore, the group that support him. And they always check first with Ajahn Brahm if it's okay. You know, is this teacher going to be all right? Is this guy all right? And Ajahn Brahm had never heard of me, but he heard that I was English. He said, oh, I'll be all right. And I met him a year later, and apparently I'd got a good report gone through to him. And so he told me, he said, oh, they came and asked me about you, but you sounded all right. I saw your picture. You didn't look too bad. So. You know, so is supportive of me, even though he doesn't know me. But, you know, many people will only go and see Ajahn Brahm, and that's just not the point. It's not the point of the way he's teaching either. So you have to be a little bit careful of the inspiration junkies, that finding a particular teacher isn't going to do it for you. What is going to do it for you is this wakefulness, this feeling of, you know, I'm here, I'm present. So after the practicing the six senses, then bringing the mind back, we have this awareness. Now we want to bring this awareness to different activities. So first activity that we bring the awareness to is with the body. So we contemplate the body while bearing in mind this wakefulness, this awareness. Now, it's very helpful to do this by doing exercises. So reaching for the doorknob. Doors are always, most teachers have some kind of Dharma teaching around doors. You know, some teachers say you have to stop for 3 seconds before you go through a door. Or reaching for the doorknob, or, you know, mindfulness of opening and closing doors. Stairs are another good one. It is useful to have touch points within your daily life. So there can be different things that you stop and contemplate before you engage in the activity, and use it in order to cultivate awareness. I used to work in a jazz club, which is about the opposite of mindfulness, as far opposite as you can get. Live music playing, very loud, thousands of people running around. The whole business was run by people like under, I think I was the oldest and I was 22. You know, so there's a lot of mayhem. We used to sell beer in jugs, and when we sold the beer, you'd be running around like crazy, and then you put the jug under the tap, and you turn the tap on, and you've got about 8 seconds of mindfulness just to stop. And then the jug is full, and then you carry on running like crazy. Well, I found many of these little touch points in my various daily activities, and this is because I wanted to. And all of Dharma really hinges on whether you want it or not. Do you really want to do it? You know, it won't depend on your teacher. It won't depend on the place. You can be in the most perfect surroundings possible. I mean, here's pretty perfect. And what do? You complain about your knee. You complain about your back. And, you know, you say, well, I'll meditate later. I'll just indulge in this one line of thought. It's really important for me to think about this right now. So we're bringing the awareness then to body. So when we're going through the various activities, we come back to the body. The body is the touch point. It keeps you in the present moment. The body is here, it's now, and it's not doing too much. It's easy to observe. So the body is always the starting point. Breath we count as body within Buddhism. Also, refined movements, standing up, sitting down, adjust the words of the sutta, adjusting the robes, putting the robes on, picking the bowl up, putting the bowl down, raising the spoon to the mouth, putting the spoon back into the bowl, urinating, defecating, walking forward, walking backwards, etc. These are what we call awareness of refined movements. If you do some of these movements deliberately while maintaining attention, so like you practice standing up, sitting down with attention, after a while it becomes automatic, and that automatic mindfulness is what we're aiming for. So that after a while, you know, even if you're eating your food, for example, we would practice this chewing, you know, watching the jaw. This is an exercise that we go through, but after a while what you find is that the awareness just arises spontaneously, and you don't need to tie it to the chewing in particular. If you think about it, why are you aware of your jaw moving and not the feeling of your bum on the seat or the wind or the draft passing past your shaved head or some other sensation? It doesn't really matter which sensation it is, so long as you're maintaining this sense of awareness. So I like to say there are two levels to the awareness of refined movements. The first is exercises, where you deliberately tie your attention to a particular movement. Especially the breathing is very helpful because the breathing is always there. And then secondly, you really lighten the load, lighten it up. And so you're just practicing awareness rather than awareness of something. Remember, whatever content it is not awareness. Awareness and content are slightly different things. So more and more you bring your attention to that faculty of awareness rather than what you're aware of. Having brought attention to body then, bring your attention to feelings and the pushing and pulling that go on all day, every day. Every action that you undertake, every line of activity you take has been pushed or pulled by this vedana, this feeling of liking and disliking. And as animals, we're really tied to liking and disliking. Even dogs, even cats, even bacteria, it's been proven, they have this liking and disliking. You put them in a sugary environment of glucose and they start heading in towards the sugar. And, you know, they go away from the non-sugar. If you start to dry it out, they head towards the damp, where they can absorb the sugar more. As human beings, we're drawn, for example, to many things, but one of the things, sugar, salt, and fat, we are drawn to, right? In a diet, in like a natural monkey's diet, sugar, salt, and fat are very hard to find. So the monkeys are naturally drawn through evolution, they're trained through evolution to really crave it. When they get sugar, salt, or fat, they really crave it and desire it because it was so important to our diet, we didn't get enough of it. The American diet, on the other hand, fills everything with sugar, salt, and fat. And it's a real problem, and it's called, in psychology, it's called hyperstimulation. One of the famous experiments was with a certain kind of gull that has an orange spot on its beak. When the chicks are born, they're drawn to this orange spot and they peck it. And so they're calling for the attention of the mother. They're not trained, they're not taught, they haven't learned this behavior. They automatically will peck at the orange spot on their mother's beak. So these cruel and nasty psychologists thought, what they'll do is they'll paint a bigger, brighter orange spot on a piece of wood that was superior to the orange spot on the mother's beak. And so what did the chicks do? They literally pecked their own brains out by attacking this spot because it was so big, so bright, so orange that they just drove themselves nuts and they literally beat their own brains out by attacking this spot. This is what we're doing with sugar, salt, and fat. You know, we're literally poisoning our bodies with this hyperstimulation. So liking and disliking, there are many kinds of liking and disliking. Graham promised he was going to tell us some stories about that. He said he had many stories, so we might catch him afterwards or maybe tomorrow. Next level then, that we maintain this sense of I'm here, this sense of wakefulness, this sense of awareness. Remember, mindfulness means sati, to call into your mind, and sampajanya, the feeling of awareness or consciousness. So while we're doing these activities, we're calling into mind this feeling of our own consciousness. This is very different to being absorbed in something else. We're bringing the attention then to mind states, to jitta. First level I like to introduce is thoughts. Actually, thoughts come under a slightly different category in Buddhism. But because we use the word slightly differently, I like to bring in thoughts together with mind states. Thoughts are vitaka vichara, and vitaka vichara are, it's like a bee, according to the commentaries, it's like a bee that sees a flower and is attracted to the sight and the scent of the flower, and as it gets close to the flower, it starts to hover around it. This is a vitaka and vichara. So vitaka has the idea of identifying an object, and vichara is hovering around the object. Vitaka and vichara have which is thinking in English, have the function of throwing your mind back onto an object, casting the mind onto an object. So if there's something that you like, vitaka and vichara will keep throwing yourself back onto this thing because the natural tendency is for everything to dissipate out of the mind. So when you get a really nice meal, when you get your Marmite on toast, what you do is you're enjoying it, and then you start to say to yourself, oh, God, this is good. God, I love Marmite. This is just fantastic. Why are you saying that? Why would you say that? Why don't you just enjoy the Marmite, right? The fact is, the enjoyment of the Marmite is going to dissipate out of the mind, and by saying it, you're throwing yourself back onto the experience. You're re-enlivening that experience within you. Same as when you dislike something, you try it, disliking something. God, I hate that. why does that person have to just talk for so long? And talk, you know, they always talk about themselves. Why, you know, they're just so selfish. What's happening? You're talking to somebody and you don't like it. Thought you're throwing yourself back onto that feeling time and time again. So thinking has this quality of throwing yourself, casting yourself, honing in on, or honing back in on a particular experience. So then the mind states are a little bit more sticky. These kind of get hold of you, and you are caught up in these mind states. And so, you know, you get the feeling of lightness, of elasticity of mind, expansion of mind, restriction of mind, concentration or diffuseness of mind, greed, lust, hate, delusion arising in the mind, and they get rather sticky and they can stay with you for quite a long time. We bring attention to these, and the main, most important point is to know it. When you're lustful, you know you're lustful. When you're greedy, you know you're greedy. When you're angry, you know you are angry. When you are happy, you know that you are happy. This particular practice is a kind of honesty, or satyabharami, truthfulness that we are endeavoring to practice. This truthfulness is how you know that you're not repressing things, how you're not suppressing things into you. Usually when you're doing something bad or something wrong, you will repress it or block it out, drive it away. You are unwilling to acknowledge the feeling. Just like if you're really angry at somebody and someone comes up to you and says, oh, you're really angry at them. You say, you can shut it as well. You know? Because you're in that feeling. You don't want to know that you're angry. You don't want to acknowledge it. You don't want to acknowledge the way that you're feeling. If you're willing to acknowledge things, then things start to change. Somebody said yesterday that, you know, feelings come up, you know, like jealousy or whatever, and she's afraid of it. As soon as she said that, I know that it's all right. Dhamma is being running its course. If you're seeing that fear of that emotion, one, it means you've been willing to see and acknowledge that emotion. Secondly, you've been willing to see and acknowledge how you feel about that emotion. Normal people are blind to this. When you talk with people who don't practice Dhamma, they're blind to this kind of thing. Seeing desire in the suffering form is normally, you know, the American dream. Live your dreams, practice your desires, get more stuff, you know. And it is actually quite American. He's really pushing this idea of desire. You know, Hollywood has two themes, desire or revenge, you know. It's either getting what you want or getting your own back on somebody, you know. These drive 90% of Hollywood movies. And to be fair to the movie producers, you know, they have to do things that make money. I think many movie producers would like to make deeper films. But of course they don't sell very well, so they're kind of stuck. So we're acknowledging, if you acknowledge mind states, then you really know when you're angry. You really know when you're happy, you really know when you're desiring, you really know when you're, you know, you're nervous, you really know when you're unhappy, etc. This has been a quick revision of what we've been going through during the past few days. The next and last category of remembering, bringing this awareness to, the last category we bring awareness to is Dhamma. And Dhamma means the underlying principles. So rather than seeing like I'm happy about this, I'm unhappy about that, I'm in anger, I'm in greed, I'm in joy, you start to see these underlying principles that lie behind everything. Rather than caring about what you get for breakfast, you start to see this various different principles. The principle that I want to introduce right now is the principle of dukkha, which of course is the first noble truth. This is one of many, many principles of Dhamma. And bringing your mind to the principles is very good because it helps to disengage you from the superficial activity of what's going on. So if your knee hurts, rather than getting engaged in your knee, you start to get interested in dukkha of the body. And so you're getting disengaged from the superficial things that are going on around you. You know, whether the weather's good or the weather's bad, food's good or the food's bad, whether you're with somebody you like or somebody you dislike. You cease caring about that kind of stuff, and you become much more interested in Dhamma instead. So dukkha, as it arises, one of the first things you see is just how much you compound dukkha. And we were talking about watching thoughts, and thoughts throw your attention back onto something. There's nothing you love to think about more than your own dukkha, your own suffering. And this is why one of the principles of the spiritual life is when you start to look inside, after the initial inspiration wears off, you just see all kinds of horrible things. That's good, that's normal, that's the way that it goes. You start to see this principle of dukkha and just how much you compound it. Something unpleasant arises and the mind condenses around that and you make a big deal out of it. And one of the big lines of insight that occurs is that many things really aren't as bad as you thought they were. You know, you get one of the ones that I liked. Years ago, I listened to a talk by Ajahn Jagera, and he was talking about not being able to sleep. And somebody complained that they weren't able to sleep. And, you know, how could they use Dharma to make them sleep? And he had a great answer. He said, what's wrong with not being able to sleep? It's nice. It's quiet. Nobody moaning at you. Nobody complaining at you. You've got hours before you've got to go to work. Comfortable bed. What's wrong with you? And it's true, isn't it? You compound something. If things don't go the way you expect them, the way you want them, you compound it. Like, well, if I don't sleep, then I'm going to be tired at work. And then I'm like, what's wrong with that? You know, you're often tired at work. Basically, every Friday, you're tired at work. It's not it's not that bad. You're not going to lose your job over it. You know, yes, but then I'll be, you know, miserable. And like, well, why are you tired at work on a Friday afternoon, but you're not tired when you go out on a Friday night? I mean, so you compound it, you know. Well, if I don't get enough sleep, I get irritable. And you're like, you're already irritable. What's wrong with not being able to sleep? It's nice. Personally speaking, ever since I heard that talk by him, I love not being able to sleep. And one of the things I really dislike is sleeping right through the night. I like to wake up during the night, at least 3 or 4 times. And there is some science behind this, believe it or not. One of the things we learn in our psychology textbooks is the sleep cycle. And you go through these different, you cycle through these different states of light sleep, going into deep sleep, going into very deep sleep, re-emerging, and you come through REM where you're dreaming. And basically each cycle takes you about 2 hours, speeds up a little bit. If it's 2.5 hours the first one, then 2 hours, then 1.5 hours, something like that. It's nice to wake up after each cycle. Like, oh great, I'm still in bed and I've still got 6 hours before I have to get up. There's nothing worse than going to bed and like waking up, okay, oh God, it's already 5 minutes late. There's also some science, I think I posted this up on my blog, talked about second sleep. And apparently in the old days, before the 1750s, when street lighting came in, candles were very expensive and oil lamps were even more expensive. So most people, when it got dark, they stopped and they went to bed. And halfway through the night, they would tend to wake up, get up and go around and do some things. And they had what they called a second sleep. And there's a lot of evidence for this in literature. And then it was only like the rich people then who were able to afford lighting and were able to stay up all night. So Ajahn Jagera, he talks about this. What's wrong with not being able to sleep? What's wrong with feeling a bit tired? What's wrong with having an aching knee? It's not that bad. One of the things you notice is that things really only hurt while you're thinking about them. It's kind of strange. You relate to your aching knee as if it's always aching. This is called object permanence. You relate to objects as if they're always there. And you have to do this in order to survive. Otherwise, you know, your husband comes in with a new haircut and looks completely different, and you'd say, well, who are you? He's changed, but you have to relate to him as if he's still exactly the same. Same with your house and everything else. So, you know, to live as a human being, you have to relate to things as if they're always there. Many animals don't do this very much. You know, a dog will bury a bone So even though it can't see or smell it, it still relates to the bone as being there. But basically a dog is pretty much on the surface. Well, practicing Dharma, we turn things around a little bit, and we start to relate to things not as if they're always there, but they're only there when I pick them up. So my childhood that my psychologist has told me is no good, and I have to fix all these things that my mother didn't appreciate, my snowman and all the rest of it, and I have to fix that. It's only there when I call it up into my mind. So now wisdom starts to arise. Well, I'm going to just call wholesome things up in my mind and not unwholesome things. I'm going to be very honest with what's in my mind. So when unwholesome things are in my mind, I see it and I know it and I acknowledge it. I have an example of this was metta practice. I like the idea of metta practice and doing loving kindness. I was very, very struck by Ajahn Viradhamma, I think it was. And there's these six monks who were murdered in America, in the States somewhere. This is about 20 years ago. And Ajahn Viradhamma announced this in the evening puja and said, okay, we're all now going to practice loving kindness for these murderers. And I was new to Dhamma at the time. And this really struck me and really inspired me. The only trouble was I couldn't do it. I didn't have any loving kindness for them, or for me, or for anybody else for that matter. You know, I loved the idea, and I could, if I tried really hard, I could just about stir something up. But it's a bit like Luke Skywalker with the Force, and he could only just about wiggle something, but he couldn't raise his spaceship out of the swamp. And he said, I don't believe it. And Yoda said to him, and that is why you fail. And I was like that with metta. If I really tried, I could just about stir something weak and feeble up, but it just straight back into the swamp. And I couldn't do it. And it was years and years, probably only about 6 years ago, that I had my first real metta experience. What it was my mind stopped still, went very, very bright, very, very happy, very, very beautiful. They talk about these soberness states of mind, beautiful states of mind. They came up, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to enjoy this for a while, and I deserve it, all that practice I've done. And then it occurred to me, why don't I call this metta, loving kindness? And so I just kind of pictured beaming it out, and then I had this loving kindness that I could call up. For years after that, I could call it up and have this beautiful, all radiant, beautiful, loving kindness that I was shined all over the world, sitting here in my perfection of love for all living creatures, so long as I was alone in my room. When I'm in a taxi and the Bangkok taxi driver doesn't know where you're going, so he takes you somewhere else instead, which is a regular occurrence, then the loving kindness is gone. So it took a lot longer after that before I could feel it underneath the superficial dislike or annoyance. And I'm talking only about a year ago that I started to really get this, where my immediate reaction underneath the surface of annoyance or irritation, I could feel underneath was actually a feeling of genuine loving kindness towards other people. Before that, I could practice it. I could make it come up if I wanted, but it wasn't there spontaneously then. What was I talking about? Compounding stuff. So you see that when the dukkha comes up, when something that you dislike comes up, you compound it, you make it worse by thinking about it, by telling yourself you can't stand it, you can't take it, you don't want it, it's not good enough, you don't deserve it, which is a great one because many people complain about getting things that they don't deserve if it's something that they dislike. But when you get something really nice that you don't deserve, you don't shake your fist at God and say, it's not fair. You know, why did I find this $25,000? I mean, it just shouldn't be like that. I have in my mind, I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. Perhaps she'll die. I know an old lady who swallowed a spider. That wriggled and wiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die. I know an old lady who swallowed a bird. How absurd. I know an old lady who swallowed a cat. Fancy that. She swallowed the cat to eat the bird. She swallowed the bird. How absurd to swallow a bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and wiggled and tickled inside. And she swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly, but now she's sure to die. Stupid rhyme. And we learned this as a kid. And like, I had no idea of the meaning, but this is the exact meaning. Something small happens. You swallow a spider. Okay, you swallow a spider. It's not that big a deal. But then you have to cure it, or you have to complain about it. You have to find a fix for it. And then you have to find a fix for that, and then for that. It's like people who get obsessed with medicines, you know, and you get a little bit of a bad leg, and they take 20 medicines for that, and then the medicines give them a headache, so they take a headache pill, and then maybe the headache is something deeper. Is that cancer? I'll go and get a scan. And then, you know, on top of all my other problems, now I'm a hypochondriac as well. So I have in my mind that old lady who swallowed a fly. And this is actually a real lesson for me of how I compounded dukkha, first noble truth. And I was working with this after I left the monastery. I'd been in the monastery for a year. I left and I went working for a year. I was working as a chef. Purely by accident. And we had a big walk-in freezer, and in the freezer it's rather unpleasant because it's cold. It was a complete mess inside this walk-in freezer because nobody would ever sort it out. And every so often the head chef would stomp in and order somebody to go and sort it out, and you stomp your way into the freezer. You do as little as possible, because what happens is you got the door open to turn the light on, and all the little icicles on the roof start melting and dripping, and they go down your back, and your shoulders freeze. I mean, you get this horrible freezing burn across your shoulders, you see. So I went in, and oh God, you know, stop my, you know, why should I have to do that? And then it's not that bad. It's a bit cold, but it's all right. Then I started sorting things out, and I found all this stuff that chefs had prepared in the past and then left in there and forgotten about. I'm like, I'll use this for the special today. I don't have to make a special for the menu now. That's all right. You know, you find all kinds of things in there. You sort it out, you put everything in the box. It's all really neat and clean and tidy. And then everyone else who walks in the freezer later on during the day goes, oh, wow, this is great. And so you get a little bit of a compliment. It's not that bad. Cleaning out the freezer isn't that bad. And so then, after a while, if I had time after my prep in the morning, I've got half an hour, I'll go and clean the freezer out. This earned me plus points with the head chef. And one of the funny advantages with this was every so often when the freezer did need cleaning out, you'd always point to somebody else to do it. And, you know, I would have this smug kind of satisfaction watching them go stumping off into the freezer to do it. It's not that bad. Washing up. We always find this strange with Americans, because what we call washing up, you call the dishes. And so we're always a bit perplexed that you wash up before dinner and we wash up after dinner. Whenever you've lived with other people, you complain about you doing the dishes. You always seem to be doing more of other people's dishes than your own. Well, change your attitude just a little bit. Like, well, I'll do it as an offering to the other people. Now it becomes kind of fun. It becomes kind of nice to do the dishes. It takes 5 minutes. It's not hard. It's not worth complaining about. It's not worth compounding dukkha over something that's easy and actually is quite pleasant. When I was chefing, we used to fight over doing the dishes because there's no stress. When you're chefing and you've got 60 people who've just ordered 60 different meals, and you think how it is cooking one meal for 60 people. We have to cook 60 different meals for 60 people. And it was nice to go and do the washing up. We just, you know, it was quite soothing. So we used to fight over it. No need to compound. So the first level of dukkha is dukkha dukkata, or the painful feelings of, first of all, the body, bodily painful feelings. Buddha also, he had painful feelings. He had a bad back. And one sutta, he says, he comes out in the morning and he sits on a log and warms his back in a ray of sunshine. And he says to Ananda, 80 years have passed by and my body is old and crooked as a roof rafter. I really like that image of the Buddha warming his back in a ray of morning sunshine in the cold season in India. The commentary is quite funny because it says, of course, the Buddha was way beyond any kind of indulgence in pleasure, and what he was really doing was charging his aura so that he would have more power for the enlightenment of world beings. That's not my kind of Buddha. I like the kind of Buddha that warmed his back in a ray of sunlight in the morning. It's simple, it's ordinary. So dukkha dukkata, we're all going to have painful feelings of the body. Dukkha dukkata also of the mind, and that is of mental suffering. And sometimes Buddhism is described as, well, you know, you may have physical suffering, but you won't have mental suffering. This is the so-called second arrow of somebody who's shot with an arrow, and the physician comes to take the arrow out, and he says, give me a second arrow so that I can stab myself with that. And this is when you have physical suffering, but you're compounding it with mental suffering. So for a long while, I had this ridiculous delusion that a Buddhist shouldn't have mental suffering. And that's also silly. You're going to have mental suffering. It's due to your conditioning. I had one example of this. My best friend died around about this week last year. And she was ready to die. She was 70 years old. And she had 3 weeks' notice. She had cancer of the small intestines. She had 3 weeks' notice. The doctor scanned her and said, look, it's everywhere, and your history. Go and have a nice holiday, because by the time you get back, you'll be finished. And she was like, right you are, great. And she was really happy. She was really radiant. And her feeling was, she's not going to get that sick. She's not going to get dependent on people. She's not going to get Alzheimer's or anything. She's lived a good life, she's been a good person, and she's ready to go. And she was clear, crystal clear. I mean, she was just totally sharp, 100% clear, ready as a human being can be. And, you know, I went around to her house a few times during this 3 weeks, and then when I'd leave the house, I'd start crying. I'm like, I'm a monk, I shouldn't be crying. I should be the one. She should be crying, and I should be the one saying, all things are unconditioned, all things are impermanent. Her final practice was equanimity. This is what she said. This is a big practice. She said, day after day for the last 20-odd days, I'm just going to practice equanimity with everything. You can do my funeral, you can do my finances, you can look after my house, my job's done. And I figured that if she can be equanimous with dying, I can be equanimous with crying. You know, I can be upset a little bit. It's all right. The idea that I can, that only physical pain is going to be affect me, and that I'm not going to have any mental suffering, is just stupid. Of course I'm going to have some mental suffering. Again, you don't compound the mental suffering with it. Okay, so it's there, it's come up. I had this idea actually in my head, you know, when the Buddha died, the sutta says all these people were weeping and wailing and beating their chest, but those who practice mindfulness simply knew all things that arise will cease. And I was pretty unhappy to find myself in the first group. But, so mental suffering is going to occur, but we can treat that with mindfulness also. We can bring awareness to that, and we can learn from those processes also. Dukkha dukkata, then, these are the three levels of dukkha, and dukkha being one of the many principles of Dharma that we start to relate to as the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The second layer of the dukkha is called viparinama dukkata, or the suffering that comes from change. Now, as I said, we start to change the way that we relate to things rather than relating to things as permanent. You know, my childhood, my pain, my health, my taxes, my everything else. You start to see things as coming up in the mind, like it's only there when it's there. And you be honest with what's there, and that's your job done. Mindfulness is described as a gatekeeper. It's not the king of the city. That's the ego, wants to be king of the city. Mindfulness is just the gatekeeper. It's only interested in what's coming in and what's going out. That's it. That's all you need to worry about. So he started to relate to things, not as always being there, not as my husband, and he does this, and he leaves the toilet seat up, and he doesn't close cupboard doors, and he smells, and he and all the rest of it. My wife, she does this and she does this, and you know, like, rather than carrying these kind of problems around with you, just look at what's coming up right here, right now. And usually you know what the appropriate action is that you should take. So this is the suffering that comes from change. And we want to be able to relate to things and be honest and see when some things come up and when some things disappeared. I have an example of this. One day I got home, and as soon as I walked through the kitchen door, my mother laid into me. You're no good. I'm sick of you. I want you out of this house. You shouldn't be here. Just like full barrage. What have I done? You know very well what you've done. Started off again. So come on, like, just what's happening? And turns out that during the day she'd made a bread pudding. And bread pudding is an old wartime recipe. It's not bread and butter pudding. It's a wartime recipe. And basically you get water, brown sugar, butter, and stale bread. You mash the stale bread into the thing, run it through the blender, bit of cinnamon, a few raisins, and stick it in the oven, and it dries like a congealed blob. And we like it. It's nice. This is Vedana, Sukha Vedana, pleasant feeling. And you make this. Now, as I say, it comes out like a congealed blob. It's something like plasticine. I mean, which is Play-Doh in American, right? You call Play-Doh? You know what I mean, plasticine as well? Okay. That kind of consistency. And she says, she'd made one during the day, and she said, and you've eaten it. I'm like, I haven't. Yes, you have. And she was laying into me. She's furious. And I said, but you made a whole one. She said, yes. And I said, but like, no human being could eat an entire bread pudding. She said, well, you could. Just then, my father comes into the kitchen, right? Tootlet, completely oblivious, as most fathers are, you know. He comes into the kitchen, he goes tootling over to the oven, he opens the oven, he pulls out the bread pudding, which was there in its entirety, aside from one little corner, which he'd had earlier, cuts himself a second piece, puts the foil over and puts it back in the oven, and my mother's face is agape. What's it doing in the oven? Because she put it out to cool, you see. And he said, well, there were some flies around, so I put it in the oven. I put it out to cool. He said, well, I didn't know. And off he stomped. Now, while he's stomping off and my mother's shouting at him, I'm leaning all over the counter with a big smarmy smile on my face because I'm waiting for my apology. No? As a man, I'm waiting for my apology. Clearly I had to learn the hard way. And so I'm looking at her, I've got this big smarmy, big smirk on my face. And she said, instead of apologizing, you know what she said? Well, it's exactly the kind of thing that you do. I said, but I didn't do it. She said, you would have eaten it if you'd seen it there. The problem had ceased, the problem had gone, but unwilling to acknowledge it, you see. So if you're practicing this Satcha Bhairami, this truthfulness of what's really there, you can stop. Okay, it's gone. That thing has changed now. Anuruddha had one of the Buddha's cousin when he ordained as a monk. It was on the basis of Viparinama Dukkata, the suffering of change. They said, because they were deciding, now that the Buddha had re-emerged after his enlightenment, the family said that some of the boys had to go and ordain with him to look after him. And this meant going out and living in the forest, dressing in rag robes, eating only what people offer, living under the trees, being attacked by wind, wind, heat, cold, winged and biting things, winged, burning and biting things, in the words of the sutta. So Aniruddha said to his other cousins, he said, I know, you guys can go and ordain with the Buddha, with Siddhartha, and I'll stay here and look after the family's land, which was, you know, the kingdom. I'll stay here and look after the kingdom. And they said, what are you going to do then? He said, well, I'll get the harvest in and then I'll be happy. And they said, well, once you get the harvest in, you know, you've got to prepare for winter. It's not easy getting through winter. He said, well, you know, I'll get the harvest in, I'll prepare for winter and then I'll be happy. And they said, but after winter, you've got to get spring comes, you've got to get all the crops in, you'll plough the fields and get everything ready. And he said, it's all right, I'll get the harvest in, I'll prepare for winter and then I'll get the crops in and then I'll be happy. And they said, you see where this is going, right? So after a few cycles of this, Aniruddha said, well, when do I stop and be happy? And they said, never. He said, right, you lot can look after the kingdom. I'm going to go and become a monk with the Buddha. And that's what he did, he and six others, including his barber, his hairdresser. And he later became one of the arahants who was foremost for the celestial eye, for opening the deva eye. So I have to actually see this a lot with lay people, because they say to me, like, do you ever get sick of being a monk? I'm like, don't you get sick of being a lay person? Filling out your tax forms every year. It's recent, right? A few weeks ago. Yeah. Filling out your tax forms every year, having to earn all this money. I see how much money people earn. I think, wow, that's a lot of money, because I don't have anything like that. And then I see how much you have to spend. I'm like, I'm really glad that, you know, that I'm a monk. I actually really feel that it's harder for you guys. You know, you have family you've got to look after, you've got jobs you've got to maintain, you've got to houses. I can't even keep my room clean, and it's 3 meters by 4 meters. And when I have guests come, I'm like, oh, can't we meet out? Can't we meet in a restaurant or something? You know, because I have to clean my stupid room. And like, how do you keep your houses clean? Really, quite honestly, as monks, we often feel that it's you guys that really have the heavy burden. And the monk, the Buddha described it as this. He said, the lay life is crowded and dusty, the ordained life is free. And, you know, we really feel like that. Last form of dukkha, sankhara dukkata, which is suffering of mind states, any kind of mind state. And when you get the eye for dukkha, you see it more and more. And dukkha gets heavier and heavier and harder the more that you practice. And this is a beautiful thing. This isn't an unhappy thing. It's the dukkha that causes you to relinquish, the dukkha that stops you from being attached to things. Now, as I said yesterday, being detached from something doesn't mean that you don't do it. Being detached from something means that you have the wherewithal, you have the awareness to choose what's appropriate and inappropriate. And you carry on doing exactly the same things that you were doing before, but there is a hidden quality now. Like to everyone else, you seem exactly the same, but you have this inner quality of awareness because of the detachment, because you're not being drawn into things in the same way that you were before. You now have the choice and the freedom of how you're going to relate to the things that you are doing. This is kind of illustrated by another Nasruddin story, and he says, I told a Nasruddin story the other day, in case anybody wasn't here. Nasruddin said, I've gained this ability to be able to see in the dark. And the people said to him, yes, but when you walk around at night, you carry a lamp with you. And he said, yes, but that's just to stop other people bumping into me. But in our case, it's true, because you do have this awakening, you do have this awareness that you're bringing to your activities. But other people looking upon you are not really going to see anything major changing. It's not like you become a Buddhist and suddenly you're all like on tiptoes and everything's so beautiful and wonderful. And if you are doing like that, being like that, you're going to crash. Really, you carry on with the same kind of activities that you were doing before. That story of a Zen monk, I don't know which one it was, but they discovered him working in a laundrette. And he was enlightened, but you know, he was working in this laundrette. Okay.
My
Upajaya gave me ordination. He would do this thing where they draw metal from the sun, this alloy that they draw through kinds of hocus pocus, I don't know. But his guru who teaches him that, and I've never met anybody is more perfect than my Upajaya, to be honest, is a guy who works in a garage. And they go and do this in the garage. So really, you never know that, you know, of other people. It's hard. It's impossible to judge other people. You don't know how their Dhamma practice is going. But also with yourself, that as these practices start to gain momentum, you should really be able to carry on with your normal activities without any major change externally. Just the internal qualities are changing. So you see this dukkha. This dukkha is carrying on with all the mind states, just any kind of mind state, just being alive, just being here. There's this underlying pervading dukkha. It starts to get annoying. And that's a good thing, because the more that you can see it and feel it, the more you gain this motivation, inspiration to practice. And they say that you don't attain to enlightenment until every core of your being desires nothing but enlightenment. And it's this dukkha that's going to do it. So we see the dukkha lies underneath everything, every activity that we're engaging in. And this is the third level of dukkha, the third level of suffering. So I'm going to stop there. Dukkha being one of the many aspects of Dharma, which is the final foundation of mindfulness. So we're arousing awareness, we're bringing it to body, that is breathing and with the refined movements. We're bringing this sense of awareness or wakefulness or presence then to feeling. When we're liking and disliking, we're being pushed and pulled through regular daily activities. We're bringing this mindfulness or wakefulness to thought, putting space around the thoughts, seeing when thoughts aren't there, being willing to sit without thoughts, and bringing it to mind states, these underlying feelings or emotions that can stay with us for a long period of time. Final foundation of mindfulness, we bring awareness with Dharma, Dharma being the Dharma principles. And the more we pay attention to the principles, then the less we are concerned with the proximate causes, and the more we are concerned with the Dharma principles. So we're less concerned with this person who's annoying me, and more concerned with this principle that, you know, I'm being shaken into dukkha, and you see the dukkha arising. The less you're concerned with arousing loving kindness with somebody that you like or respect, and the more you just see it as a Dharma principle that's worth developing in its own right, and so on and so forth. Good.